Rossmo's anchor point was near the intersection of Coyle Avenue and Milburn Street. Less than half a mile northwest of the anchor point Paul had postulated, without ever having seen Rossmo's analysis. See Figure 5 on the PDF. Finding the killer with familial DNA. Scrolling through the rest of the 3,500 documents in Michelle's hard drive, one comes upon a file titled Recent DNA Results, which features the ear's YSTR markers, short tandem repeats on the Y chromosome that establish male line ancestry, including the elusive rare PGM marker. Having the Golden State Killer's DNA was always the one ace up this investigation's sleeve. But a killer's DNA is only as good as the databases we can compare it to. There was no match in CODIS, and there was no match in the California Penal System's YSTR database. If the killer's father, brothers, or uncles had been convicted of a felony in the past 16 years, an alert would have gone to Paul Holes or Erica Hutchcraft, the current lead investigator in Orange County. They would have looked into the man's family, zeroed in on a member who was in the area of the crimes, and launched an investigation. But they had nothing. There are public databases that the DNA profile could be used to match, filled not with convicted criminals, but with genealogical buffs. You can enter the STR markers on the Y chromosome of the killer into these public databases and try to find a match, or at least a surname that could help you with the search. Paul Holes had done this in 2013, and just like Michelle, smiling and proclaiming, "I've solved it," Holes thought he had finally caught the man via this technique. Michelle tells the story in this half-finished section, titled Sacramento, 2013. Paul Holes can still hear the sound of his filing cabinet drawer slamming shut. He'd emptied out everything pertaining to the ear, boxed it up, and FedExed it to Larry Poole in Orange County. Larry's got it, Holes thought. Only a matter of time. A decade later, Holes was sitting in his office, bored out of his mind. He was chief of the crime lab now, on his second marriage. Two more small children with the second wife. He'd worked at the crime lab long enough to see entire specialties discredited. Hair analysis? Made him cringe to even think about it. He and his co-workers sometimes sat around and laughed at the tools they used to have to work with, unwieldy and defective instruments, like the first generation of mobile phones. He was starting to make good on the promise he always said he would, that he put off for a decade in order to accrue steady promotions and provide for his family. Investigator Paul Holes. He always liked the sound of it. He was meeting the right people, getting the right credentials. A move to the DA's office to work cold case investigation full-time was already in the works. But there was one problem, one he knew full well he was going to take with him to the DA's office. The ear. Each year he hadn't surfaced, nabbed by DNA or turned in by a tipster, Holes's interest grew. His wife might call it an obsession. Spreadsheets were made. Leisurely car rides turned into crime scene tours. Not once, but weekly. Sometimes when he thought of the destruction wrought by one faceless man, not just the victims, but also the victims' families, the detective's shame, the wasted money and time and effort and family time and ruined marriages and sex foregone for lifetimes. Holes rarely swore. Wasn't him. But when he thought about all this, he just felt, fuck you. Fuck you. The first generation of detectives who worked the case were having health problems. The second generation of detectives, who worked it when they could grab time here and there, were retiring soon. Time was running out. The ear was looking back at them, smirking from a door half closed. Holes scooted his chair over to his computer. In the last year, ancestral DNA had become popular with people curious about their genealogy, and, though this was much less publicized, as a tool for finding unidentified criminals. Many in law enforcement were wary. There were quality assurance issues, privacy issues. Holes knew DNA, knew it well. In his opinion, ancestral DNA was a tool, not a certainty. He had a Y-DNA profile generated from the ear's DNA, which means he isolated the ear's paternal lineage. The Y-DNA profile could be input into certain genealogical websites, the kind that people use to find first cousins and the like. You input a set of markers from your Y-DNA profile, anywhere from 12 to 111, and a list of matches is returned, surnames of families with whom you might share a common ancestor. Almost always the matches are at a genetic distance of one from you, which doesn't mean much, relative-seeking-wise. You're looking for the elusive zero, a close match. Holes did this every couple of weeks. He kept his expectations at zero, a way to feed the obsession. So it was that on an afternoon in mid-March 2013, he input the familiar sequence and hit return. After a moment, the list appeared, many of them familiar surnames from his previous searches. But he didn't recognize the name at the very top of the list. The ear has one extremely rare marker. Only 2% of the world's population has this marker. When Holes clicked on the link of the top name, he saw that the profile contained this rare marker. It also matched 11 other ear markers, all the same, zero genetic distance. Holes had never received a zero G distance before. He didn't know what to do first. He picked up the phone to call Ken Clark, the Sacramento County Sheriff's detective he talked to the most, but then hung up before dialing. Sacramento was an hour drive from Holes's office in Martinez. He grabbed his car keys. He'd go to the place where, 36 years ago, it all began. Michelle never got to finish the punchline, the kind of punchline that could have driven anyone who had been working on this case for so long over the edge. It turns out that a retired Secret Service agent, an amateur sleuth named Russ Owis, had anonymously uploaded ears markers into the same database. So the match Paul Holes thought he had was actually the result of two guys uploading the same killer's DNA profile and getting a mirror image match. DNA was the thread Michelle felt was the best way to get out of the maze of the Golden State Killer. California was one of only 9 states in America that allowed testing of familial DNA within the state's database. If the GSK's brother was arrested for a felony tomorrow, we would see a hit. But that database contains only people who have been convicted of a crime. Michelle thought she might have found the killer when she had uploaded his DNA profile to a YSTR database available online from Ancestry.com, viewable on the PDF enhancement. On quick glance, at the top of the page, it looks promising. The name at the top, we are obscuring all the names, has many hits, as seen by the check marks. The name is very uncommon, only a handful in the United States and England. Next to the name, MRCA stands for Most Recent Common Ancestor. And the number is the number of generations you have to look back in your family tree to have a 50% probability that you will find a common ancestor. The MRCA between the man and Michelle, standing in for the killer's DNA, is estimated to have lived 11 generations ago, with a 50% probability. After sharing her find with Paul Holes and other experts, Michelle would discover that it wasn't quite as significant as she initially thought. You would have to go back through this guy's family 330 years, and even then you'd have only a 50-50 chance of finding him. Finding the exact person with these results was a no-go with this test. One of those experts Michelle consulted was Colleen Fitzpatrick, a forensic genealogist who aids people in finding their birth parents, and who has been instrumental in helping solve some major crimes, including Phoenix's infamous canal killer. Fitzpatrick wrote the book on forensic genealogy, literally, and spent many hours, some of them the early AM variety, on the phone with Michelle, discussing the various ways of approaching the genealogical route to identifying the GSK. Forensic Genealogy by Colleen Fitzpatrick was published in 2005. After Michelle died, Colleen explained to Billy that even though we don't have a usable lineage to follow from the above comparison, we do have a clue. Even if you come up with Y matches that are distant, but they all have the same name, you can say that is probably Mr. X's last name, and he belongs to the same extended family as those matches, along the direct line, maybe going back many generations. But in this case, there are a variety of names, so you can't pin one down. The flavor of the names can sometimes give you some ethnicity for your Mr. X. Say, if his list is made of all Irish names, you can say he's probably Irish. That is what I did on the canal murders. Not only did I come up with the name Miller for their canal murderer, I also told the Phoenix PD that he was a Miller of Irish extraction. A few weeks later, they arrested Brian Patrick Miller. That's where I got the idea that the ear had a German name, but was from the UK. In the tests I ran for Michelle, that's the flavor of names I was coming up with. So we were looking for a guy with a German name whose family at some point lived in the UK. Of course, he could have been adopted. Then all bets are off. It all comes down to the size of the database you are trying to compare your sample to. By 2016, there were numerous companies offering to run your DNA profile and add it to a rapidly expanding dataset. These companies use autosomal DNA testing. For around $100 and a little bit of your saliva, the companies deliver your DNA profile. On top of learning whether you might possibly get Alzheimer's in the future, or the odds of your eye color, the test is used by adoptees, or people who were raised by single moms. The results that come back to them can deliver previously unknown first cousins, and from there, they can find their birth fathers and other information about their own identities. If you don't get a hit at first, there is still hope. The companies send you emails when new family members have uploaded their DNA. "You have new DNA relatives," read one Billy recently received from 23andMe, having submitted his own DNA a few years back. 51 people who share DNA with you have joined DNA relatives over the past 90 days. The tests do not connect just male lineage. They connect everyone. Most important, the databases are huge. 23andMe has 1.5 million profiles, and Ancestry has 2.5 million. Just think of how many murders, rapes, and other violent crimes could be solved if law enforcement could enter the DNA from crime scenes into these databases and be pointed in the right direction via a cousin of the perpetrator found in the system. Unfortunately, neither company will work with law enforcement, citing privacy issues and their terms of service. The idea that the answer to this mystery is probably hiding in the databases of 23andMe and Ancestry.com kept Michelle up at night. If we could just submit the killer's actual genetic material, as opposed to only select markers, to one of these databases, the odds are great that we would find a second or third cousin, and that person would lead investigators to the killer's identity. So the answer may very well be sitting behind this locked door. A lock made up of privacy issues and illegal search and seizure issues. Michelle wanted to be able to enter the killer's DNA into these rapidly expanding commercial databases. She would have eschewed their terms of service to do so. But to enter your DNA into those databases, the company sends you a tube that you spit in and send back to them. Michelle did not have the killer's spit or even a swab. She had the profile on paper. But according to a scientist friend of Billy's, there was a way around that. Nevertheless, when critics talk privacy, the terms of use of the businesses, and the Fourth Amendment, they evoke the classic statement by Ian Malcolm, as played by Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. "Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should." When Michelle began working on the feature for Los Angeles Magazine that served as the basis for this book, official case files began trickling into her possession. She read the materials carefully and began building an index of people, places, and things named in the reports. The purpose was threefold: to promote easy location of investigative elements within the reports, to disambiguate individuals and find those who may be of interest on the basis of later geographic movement, and to find overlapping names or possible common bonds among victims. Michelle had cultivated relationships with investigators, both active and retired, that evolved into open exchanges of information. She was like an honorary investigator, and her energy and insight reinvigorated the case's tired blood. She passed our findings, along with the master list, to some of the active investigators. The collection of official case materials continued to grow. The culmination was a stunning acquisition of physical case materials in January 2016, when Michelle and Paul were led to a narrow closet at the Orange County Sheriff's Department that housed 65 banker's boxes full of Iran's case files. Remarkably, they were permitted to look through them, under supervision, and borrow what they wanted. This was the motherlode. They set aside 35 of the boxes, along with two large plastic bins, to take back to L.A. Michelle had thought ahead. Instead of sharing a day trip in one vehicle, they motorcaded into Santa Ana in dual SUVs. They stacked the banker's boxes onto dollies and wheeled them down to the loading dock behind OCSD headquarters, where they stuffed them into the two vehicles, while the undersheriff, unaware of what they were doing, emerged from the building and luckily didn't seem to notice what was going down. They moved as quickly as physically possible, lest people at OCSD change their mind. They returned to L.A., and the boxes were moved to the second floor of Michelle's house. What had been her daughter's playroom would now become the box room. They soon began digging through the materials. All the holy grails, the holdouts Michelle had not yet seen, were there, as were mountains of supplemental reports. Supplemental reports, compiled from the orphans and outliers, the one-offs that drifted to the back of the ear filing cabinet in the absence of real estate in a specific case folder, were among the materials that they coveted the most. Michelle and Paul shared the belief that if the offender's name was anywhere in these files, it was likely one of those clues in the margins. The forgotten suspect, the overlooked witness report, the out-of-place vehicle that was never followed up on, or the prowler who at the time gave what seemed like a reasonable explanation for his presence in the area. Michelle purchased two high-volume digital scanners, and they began scanning the materials. Much of this material had not been seen by active investigators like Paul Holes, Ken Clark, and Erica Hutchcraft. Scanning would not only allow the files to become easily accessible and make the text searchable, but it would allow Michelle to reciprocate the generous spirit of these investigators by providing them an invaluable service. This was the single most exciting break since the investigation began. This was a major pivot, a game changer. Michelle believed that the probability of the offender's name being somewhere in those boxes was about 80%. After the Los Angeles Magazine article was published, Michelle wrote a blog post about the letters she was getting from armchair detectives who had read the story and became obsessed, even for just a few hours, with cracking the case. In the last week, I've received dozens of responses from readers about my article, In the Footsteps of a Killer. Many emails contained insights about the evidence and fresh ideas for how best to catch the Golden State Killer, the elusive serial violent offender that from 1976 to 1986 preyed on victims up and down California. The map drew the most ideas, with many readers contributing theories based on their professional or academic backgrounds. One reader, a general contractor with experience with golf-planned communities, felt the map looked like many of the communities he'd worked on. The hand-drawn paths, he said, resembled golf cart paths. Another had a chilling insight into the detailed property lines. They're indicating fence lines, the tipster wrote, because the mapmaker is showing barriers he would encounter while moving around in the dark. One reader felt there was a clue in the "mad is the word" that reminds me of sixth grade journal entry. The six in sixth grade looked more like a G, she pointed out, adding that the writer clearly went back and inserted the word "the" before the six, as if changing what he was originally going to write, which in her opinion was probably the name of the town he grew up in. A town, she surmised, which begins with G. The "mad is the word" evidence details the writer's anger toward his male sixth grade teacher. More than one reader pointed out that male sixth grade teachers were relatively unusual in the 1960s, when the writer presumably was in elementary school. Another reader noted that Visalia, where the Golden State Killer may have started out as a younger offender, was home to many pilots from nearby Naval Air Station Lemoore. The killer may have been the son of a pilot, the tipster theorized, as several other locations in the crime series are close to military air bases. Some of these clues might help form the picture of the killer, and some might have absolutely nothing to do with him. Like a jigsaw puzzle you buy at a garage sale that's been mixed up with pieces from 20 other jigsaw puzzles. Michelle was determined, to the end, to investigate each and every piece to see if it fit. One of the last documents modified on her hard drive, dated April 18, 2016, 3 days before her death, was titled, "Still to Do." Find out from Debbie D. about flashlight. Would they have brought flashlight from other house? To her knowledge, did Greg visit Toltec? One of the detectives needed psychiatric leave after OM, Offerman Manning, and Ray said worst crime scene he ever saw. This was an email to Irwin. Why worse than Domingo Sanchez? For Erica, since my training isn't in reading crime scenes, what do you think happened at Cruz? For Ken Clark, was there a public press link to Majori at the time of the homicide? Is it true FBI ran familial and expected 200 to 400 hits for names and got zero? Find out from Ken exactly what he meant about the husband or the guy in the clown suit walking down the street. The questions go on for pages and pages. On Michelle's blog, True Crime Diary, we will begin to try to get the answers to the questions she had left open. The discussions of the case are ongoing, and we invite readers to join in and follow the numerous message boards that light up day and night with new clues and different theories about the killer. Michelle always said she didn't care who solved this case, just as long as it got solved. There's no question as to Michelle's impact on the case. In the words of Ken Clark, she brought attention to one of the least known, yet most prolific serial offenders ever to operate in the United States. If I hadn't read the reports for myself during my years of investigation on this case, the story would be almost unbelievable. Her professional research, attention to detail, and sincere desire to identify the suspect allowed her to strike a balance between the privacy of those who suffered while exposing the suspect in a way that someone may recognize. It is not easy to gain the trust of so many detectives across so many jurisdictions, Erica Hutchcraft told us, but she managed to do so, and you knew it was by her reputation, her perseverance, and the fact that she cared about the case. Paul Holes concurred, going so far as to say that he considered Michelle to be his detective partner on the case. We were constantly in communication. I would get excited about something and would send it to her, and she would also get excited. She would dig and find a name and send it to me to look into. This case is the ultimate emotional roller coaster. The highs are amazing when you think you have found the guy, and then you crash when you eliminate the promising suspect through DNA. Michelle and I shared in those ups and downs. I had my good suspects, and she had hers. We would send emails back and forth in a growing crescendo of excitement, only to experience the finality of an elimination. Michelle was able to accomplish gaining not only my trust, but the trust of the entire task force, and proved herself as a natural investigator, adding value with her own insights and tenacity. The ability to learn the case, have insights that many do not have the aptitude for, the persistence, and the fun and engaging personality all wrapped up in one person was amazing. I know she was the only person who could have accomplished what she did in this case, starting out as an outsider and becoming one of us over time. I think this private-public partnership was truly unique in a criminal investigation. Michelle was perfect for it. I last saw Michelle in Las Vegas, where we spent a lot of time together talking about the case. Little did I know this would be the last time I would see her face to face. Her last email to me was Wednesday, 4:20. As always, she let me know she was sending me some files she and her researcher had found and thought I should know about. She ended that email with, "Talk to you soon, Michelle." I downloaded those files she sent after I found out about her passing Friday night. She was still helping me. In an email to her editor in December 2013, Michelle addressed what every true crime journalist has to come to grips with when writing about an unsolved crime. How does the story end? I'm still optimistic about developments in the case, but not blind to the challenge of writing about a currently unsolved mystery. I did have one idea on that front. After my magazine article was published, I received tons of emails from readers, almost all starting along the lines of, "You may have thought of this, but if not, what about..." insert some investigative idea. It really confirmed for me that inside everyone lurks a Sherlock Holmes that believes that given the right amount of clues, they could solve a mystery. If the challenge here, or perceived weakness, is that the unsolved aspect will leave readers unfulfilled, why not turn that on its head and use it as a strength? I have literally hundreds of pages of analyses from both back in the day and, more recently, geoprofiles, analysis of footwear, days of the week he attacked, etc. One idea I had was to include some of those in the book, to offer the reader the chance to play detective. We will not stop until we get his name. We'll be playing the detective as well. Billy Jensen and Paul Haynes, May 2017.
Afterward. Michelle was bored by anything with magic or spaceships. "I'm out," she'd say with a laugh. Ray guns, wands, glowing swords, superhuman abilities, ghosts, time travel, talking animals, super science, enchanted relics, or ancient curses. All of that feels like cheating. "Is he building another suit of armor?" she asked during a screening of the first Iron Man movie. 20 minutes into the movie, Tony Stark tweaks and improves his boxy gray Mark I armor into the candy apple red and regal gold supersuit. Michelle chuckled and went out to go shopping. Spaghetti westerns were too long and too violent. Zombies were scientifically implausible. And diabolical serial killers with complex schemes were, as far as she was concerned, unicorns. Michelle and I were married for 10 years and together for 13. There was not a single pop culture point of connection between the two of us. Oh, wait, The Wire. We both liked The Wire. There you go. When we met, I was a burbling, fizzing cauldron of obscure ephemera and disjointed facts, movies, novels, comics, music, and serial killers. I knew body counts and modi operandi and quotes from interviews. Stockpiling serial killer lore is a rite of passage for guys in their 20s who want to seem dark and edgy. I was precisely the kind of dork who, in my 20s, would do anything to seem dark and edgy. And there I was, all through the flannel 90s, rattling off minutiae about Henry Lee Lucas and Carl Panzram and Edmund Kemper. Michelle knew those facts and trivia as well, but for her, it was background noise, as unimportant and ultimately uninteresting as poured cement. What interested her, what sparked her mind and torqued every neuron and receptor, were people, specifically detectives and investigators, men and women who, armed with a handful of random clues, or more often than not, too many clues that needed to be sifted through and discarded as red herrings, could build traps to catch monsters. Ugh. Okay, that was the movie tagline description of what Michelle did. Sorry, it's hard for me not to spiral upward into hyperbole when I talk about her. I was married to a crime fighter for a decade, an emphatically for real, methodical, little gray cells, great brain type crime fighter. I saw her righteous fury when she'd read survivor testimony or interview family members who were still reeling from the wrenching away of a loved one. There were mornings when I'd bring her coffee and she'd be at her laptop weeping, frustrated and worn flat by another lead she chased that left her smashed nose first against a brick wall. But then she'd have a slug of caffeine, wipe her eyes, and hammer away at the keyboard again. A new window opened, a new link pursued, another run at this murderous, vile creep. The book you just read was as close as she got. She always said, "I don't care if I'm the one who captures him. I just want bracelets on his wrists and a cell door slamming behind him." And she meant it. She was born with a true cop's heart and mind. She craved justice, not glory. Michelle was an incredible writer. She was honest, sometimes to a fault, with her readers, with herself, and about herself. You see that in the memoir sections of I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And you see how she was honest about her own obsessions, her own mania, her at times dangerous commitment to the pursuit, often at the expense of sleep and health. The mind for investigation and logic, the heart for empathy and insight. She combined those two qualities in ways I'd never encountered before, without even trying. She made me rethink my own path in life, my own way of relating to people, and the things that I valued. She made everything about me and everyone around her better, and she did it by being quietly, effortlessly original. Let me give you a specific anecdotal example and then a broader, more universal one. Anecdotal. In 2011, I worked with Phil Rosenthal to develop a sitcom based on my life. Louie had been on the air for a year, and I was besotted by the new ground it was breaking in terms of how to structure a sitcom and how to present the personal in a comedic way. I basically wanted my own Louie, and so Phil and I sat down and walked through the details of my day-to-day life. "What does your wife do?" Phil asked during an afternoon writing session. I told him. I told him that she'd started a blog called True Crime Diary. I said it began as a way for her to write about the numerous cold cases and developing cases she followed online. I explained that she'd incorporate possible suspects' MySpace entries. Social media is a gold mine for investigators, she realized. The old pulling teeth method of getting suspects to talk was nothing compared to the mind dump these sociopathic narcissists offer daily on their own Tumblr, Facebook, and Twitter accounts. She used Google Maps and a dozen other new platforms to construct solutions to seemingly dead-end cases. She was especially adept at linking data from an obscure, decades-old case to a seemingly unconnected current crime. You see how he's improving his M.O.? Failed kidnapping attempt on a street without easy freeway access has evolved into a clean snatch right near the cloverleaf where he can merge and reverse. He built up his courage and his skills. It's the same car in each case. And he's going unnoticed because it's a different state, and a lot of times different police forces won't share info. That particular monologue, I remembered, was delivered one night in bed, laptop propped up against her knees. This was Michelle's idea of pillow talk. Her blog entries led to interest from cable news shows, then to Dateline NBC, which hired her to re-interview suspects in a Mormon Black Widow murder case. The persons of interest had stonewalled when approached by a major network, but they were more than happy to blab to a blogger. They just didn't realize that the blogger they were talking to had invented a mutant, more expansive form of homicide investigation. They told her everything. Phil mused over all this for a minute or so after I finished talking. Then he said, "Well, that's a way more interesting show than what we're working on. How about your TV wife as a party planner? Sound good?" Now for the more universal example of Michelle's uniqueness. We live in a swipe-right, blip-span culture of clickbait, 140-character arguments, and 30-second viral videos. It's easy to get someone's attention, but it's almost impossible to keep it. Michelle was dealing with a subject that demands sustained, often unrewarded attention to yield any sort of satisfaction or closure. It requires the attention of not just a single reader, but of dozens of cops, data miners, and citizen journalists to spark even a minor breakthrough. Michelle earned and sustained that attention through flawless, compelling writing and storytelling. You understand everyone's point of view in her writing, and none of her subjects or characters she invented. They're people that she got to know, cared about, and took the time to really see: the police, the survivors, the bereaved, and, as hard as it is for me to fathom, even a wounded, destructive insect like the Golden State Killer. I'm still hoping he hears that cell door slam behind him, and I hope she hears it somehow, too. This past Christmas, Alice, our daughter, opened a present that Santa had left her. She was happy, unwrapping her little digital camera and messing around with the settings. Fun gift. Happy holidays, sweetie. Later that morning, she asked, out of the blue, "Daddy, why do you and Santa Claus have the same handwriting?" Michelle Eileen McNamara is gone, but she left behind a little detective and a mystery. Patton Oswalt, Herndon, Virginia, July 2nd, 2017.
Epilogue. Letter to an Old Man. You were your approach. The thump against the fence. A temperature dip from a jimmied open patio door. The odor of aftershave permeating a bedroom at 3 a.m. A blade at the base of the neck. "Don't move, or I'll kill you." Their hardwired threat detection systems flickered meekly through the sledgehammer of sleep. No one had time to sit up. Awakening meant understanding they were under siege. Phone lines had been cut, bullets emptied from guns, ligatures prepared and laid out. You forced action from the periphery, a blur of mask and strange, gulping breaths. Your familiarity freaked them. Your hands flew to hard-to-find light switches. You knew names, number of kids, hangouts. Your pre-planning gave you a crucial advantage, because when your victims awoke to the blinding flashlight and clenched-teeth threats, you were always a stranger to them. But they never were to you. Hearts drummed, mouths dried. Your physicality remained unfathomable. You were a hard-soled shoe felt fleetingly, a penis slathered in baby lotion thrust into a pair of bound hands. Do it good. No one saw your face. No one felt your full body weight. Blindfolded, the victims relied on smell and hearing. Floral talcum powder. Hint of cinnamon. Chimes on a curtain rod. Zipper opening on a duffel bag. Coins falling to the floor. A whimper. A sob. "Oh, Mom." A glimpse of royal blue brushed leather tennis shoes. The barking of dogs fading away in a westerly direction. You were what you left behind. A 4-inch vertical cut in the window screen at the ranch house on Montclair in San Ramon. A green-handled hatchet on the hedges. A piece of cord hanging in a birch tree. foam on an empty Schlitz malt liquor bottle in the backyard. Smears of unidentifiable blue paint. Frame 4 of Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department's photo roll 3 of the spot where they believe you came over the fence. A girl's purpled right hand, which was numb for hours. The outline of a crowbar in dust. 8 crushed skulls. You were a voyeur, a patient recorder of habits and routines. The first night a husband working dispatch switched to the graveyard shift, you pounced. There were 4 to 7 day-old herringbone shoe impressions beneath the bathroom window at the scene on the 3800 block of Thornwood, Sacramento. Officers noted that standing there you could stare into the victim's bedroom. Fuck me like your old man, you hissed, like you knew how that was done. You put high heels on one girl, something she did in bed with her boyfriend. You stole bikini Polaroids as keepsakes. You stalked around with your needling flashlight and clipped repetitive phrases, both director and star of the movie unspooling in your head. Almost every victim describes the same scene, a time they could sense you return after a period of distracted ransacking in another part of the house. No words, no movement. But they knew you were standing there, could imagine the lifeless gaze coming from the 2 holes in your ski mask. One victim felt you staring at the scar on her back. After a long while of hearing nothing, she thought, "He's gone." She exhaled, just as the knife tip came down and began tracing the end of the scar. Fantasy adrenalized you. Your imagination compensated for failed reality. Your inadequacies reeked. One victim experimented with reverse psychology and whispered, "You're good." You abruptly got off her, amazed. Your tough guy bravado smelled like a bluff. There was a shakiness to your clenched teeth whisper, an occasional stutter detected. Another victim described to police how you'd briefly grabbed her left breast, like it was a doorknob. "Oh, isn't this good?" you asked one girl as you raped her, and held a knife to her throat until she agreed. Your fantasies ran deep, but they never tripped you up. Every investigation into an at-large violent offender is a foot race. You always maintained the lead. You were savvy. You knew to park just outside the standard police perimeter, between 2 houses or on a vacant lot to avoid suspicion. You punched small holes in the glass panes, used a tool to nudge wooden latches, and opened windows while your victims remained asleep. You turned off the AC so you could hear if someone was coming. You left side gates open and rearranged patio furniture so you had a straight shot out. Pedaling a 10-speed, you escaped an FBI agent in a car. You scuttled across roofs. In Danville, on July 6, 1979, a tracker's dog reacted so strongly to an ivy shrub on Sycamore Hill Court that the tracker believed the scent pool was just moments old. A neighbor witnessed you escape the scene of one attack. You exited the house the way you entered, without pants. Helicopters, roadblocks, citizen patrols taking down plate numbers, hypnotists, psychics, hundreds of white males chewing on gauze. Nothing. You were a scent and shoe impressions. Bloodhounds and detectives tracked both. They led away. They led nowhere. They led into the dark. For a long time, you have the advantage. Your gait is propulsive. In your wake are the police investigations. The worst episode in a person's life is recorded in sloppy cursive by an often rushed and sleepy officer. Misspellings abound. Pubic hair texture is described by a doodle in the margin. Investigators follow leads using slowly dialed rotary phones. When no one is home, the phone just continues to ring. If they want to look up an old record, they dig through stacks of paper by hand. The clattering teletype machine punches messy holes in paper tape. Viable suspects are eliminated based on their mother's alibis. Eventually, the case report is put in a file, a box, and then a room. The door is shut. Yellowing of paper and fading of memory commence. The race is yours to win. You're home free. You can feel it. The victims recede from view. Their rhythm is off, their confidence drained. They're laden with phobias and made tentative by memory. Divorce and drugs beset them. Statutes of limitations expire. Evidence kits are tossed for lack of room. What happened to them is buried, bright and unmoving, a coin at the bottom of a pool. They do their best to carry on. So do you. But the game has lost its edge. The script is repetitive and requires higher stakes. You began at windowsills, then crossed inside. The fear response stirred you. But 3 years in, grimaces and pleading will no longer suffice. You yield to your darker impulses. Your murder victims are stunners all. Some have complicated love lives. To you, I'm certain, they are whores. It was a different set of rules. You knew you had at least 15 minutes to flee a neighborhood when your victims were left bound and alive in their homes. But when you walk out of Lyman and Charlene Smith's in Ventura on March 13, 1980, you feel no need to rush. Their bodies won't be found for 3 days. Fireplace log. Crowbar. Wrench. You kill your victims with objects picked up at their homes. Unusual, maybe. But then it's always been your habit to be fleet of foot and unencumbered by very little but rage. And then after May 4th, 1986, you disappear. Some think you died or went to prison. Not me. I think you bailed when the world began to change. It's true, age must have slowed you. The testosterone, once a gush, was now a trickle. But the truth is, memories fade. Paper decays. But technology improves. You cut out when you looked over your shoulder and saw your opponents gaining on you. The race was yours to win. You were the observer in power, never observed. An initial setback came on September 10, 1984, in a lab at Leicester University, when geneticist Alec Jeffries developed the first DNA profile. Another came in 1989, when Tim Berners-Lee wrote a proposal for the World Wide Web. People who weren't even aware of you or your crimes began devising algorithms that could help find you. In 1998, Larry Page and Sergey Brin incorporated their company, Google. Boxes with your police reports were hauled out, scanned, digitized, and shared. The world hummed with connectivity and speed. Smartphones. Optical character recognition technology. Customizable interactive maps. Familial DNA. I've seen photos of the waffle stomper boot impressions you left in the dirt beneath a teenage girl's bedroom on July 17, 1976, in Carmichael, a crude relic from a time when voyeurs had no choice but to physically plant themselves in front of windows. You excelled at the stealth sidle. But your heyday prowess has no value anymore. Your skill set has been phased out. The tables have been turned. Virtual windows are opening all around you. You, the Master Watcher, are an aging, lumbering target in their crosshairs. A ski mask won't help you now. One victim's phone rang 24 years after her rape. "You want to play?" a man whispered. It was you, she was certain. You played nostalgic, like an arthritic former football star running game tape on a VCR. "Remember when we played?" I imagine you dialing her number, alone in a small, dark room, sitting on the edge of your twin bed, the only weapon left in your arsenal firing up a memory, the ability to trigger terror with your voice. One day soon you'll hear a car pull up to your curb, an engine cut out. You'll hear footsteps coming up your front walk, like they did for Edward Wayne Edwards, 29 years after he killed Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew in Sullivan, Wisconsin. Like they did for Kenneth Lee Hicks, 30 years after he killed Lori Billingsley in Aloha, Oregon. The doorbell rings. No side gates are left open. You're long past leaping over a fence. Take one of your hyper, gulping breaths, clench your teeth, inch timidly toward the insistent bell. This is how it ends for you. "You'll be silent forever, and I'll be gone in the dark," you threatened a victim once. "Open the door. Show us your face. Walk into the light." Michelle McNamara. This is Gabra Zachman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer. by Michelle McNamara. This program was recorded at Studio 300 in Chicago, at LA Studios in Hollywood, and at John Marshall Media in New York City. It was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer and director, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Tell Me Productions. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.